This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
We're given in this week's Sedra regarding the carrying out of justice in the community is v'shoichad lo yisikoch ki ha'shoichad ya'aveh pikhim v'ishalef divrei tzadikim. Thou shalt not take bribes, because bribery blinds wise people and distorts the words of righteous people, or distorts righteous words. So there's an issur in the Torah to take bribery. We need to understand that all the mishpatim, all these laws given in this week's Sedra, are Torah laws, quite apart from being social laws. And although many of the laws are universal, many of them apply to all societies, and although there's a requirement of the non-Jewish world also to develop a legal system and to practice a legal system, yet the laws as they're given in the Torah have a completely different dimension to any other legal system. In that in the Torah, every law is not only a law designed to protect society, but is also a law designed to as a moral principle in its own right, and a law designed as any other mitzvah of the Torah to be mitzarif es habriyus, to refine the individual, to elevate the individual, to uplift the individual. That's part of the Torah, and the mishpatim are as much a part of the Torah as any other part of the Torah. And so while the prohibition of bribery is a very logical and straightforward prohibition, and one which applies to all nations, yet in the Torah sense, it has a different dimension which we need to discover. For example, Rashi brings, V'sheichad lo'isikoch, afilu lishpoit emes. Even if you are paid to judge truthfully, even if somebody comes, one of the sides comes and says, look, I don't want you to find in my favor. I'm paying you, but that's just in appreciation of your efforts to reach a true judgment. That's all I want from you. You're under no obligation to me. That also is not acceptable. The Gemara asks, in Ksubistaf Kufhei Amud Beis, Omar Rove, my time de shuchto. What is the reason of the prohibition of taking bribes? Strange question Rove asked. It seems to be obvious. Surely that's an unnecessary sort of question to ask. Why are you not allowed to take bribes? Imagine if you ask such a question today. If you're just in general society. If somebody said, you know, it's not right to take bribes, and you came and said, why not? What would people say of you? Well, what kind of a human being are you? Never mind what kind of a Jew are you. To ask such a... Why bribes? Rava asks, my time at the shugda. Why aren't you allowed to take a bribe? Strange kasha. We assume that the reason for not taking a bribe is that we're afraid that the bribe is going to, the fact that the judge now has an interest in one of the parties is going to make him want to develop that interest in his own favor. Answers Rava, Kiven de kabil le shuchto mine, once he has received a bribe from him, ikruva le daite le gabe, then he becomes identified with him, bahavi ke gufe, a whole long philosophy Rava gives. And he becomes at one with that person. And a person doesn't see himself to be in the wrong. In other words, Rava says, we're not afraid that he's going to paskin, that he's going to decide in favor of the person who gave him the bribe, because he wants the money. That's not what we're afraid. Rava starts from the viewpoint of who are these dayonim? To whom was this mitzvah given? It's not given just to ordinary people. These are given to great Talmidei Chachomim. Who are the Dayonim? This is the Sanhedrin it's talking to. To the greatest of the great. So it's talking about the Vilna Gons, and the Chassam Sefers, and the Noida Yehudas, and the Chofetz Chaims, and the Reb Moshe Feinsteins. That's the kind of people that it's talking to. It's not talking to ordinary people. And it's telling them, Lo Yisikach Sheikhat, you may not take Sheikhat. Ki Sheikhat Yaveh Pikhim, people who the Torah calls a Pikach. It's not just people who you and I call a Pikach, or the Star of Sunday Times calls a Pikach. No, we're not talking about those people. We're talking about people that the Ribbono Shel Olam calls a Pikach, a wise person. Even people of the stature that the Torah says of them that he's a Pikach, he's a Tzaddik. Even those people are at risk when it comes to Sheikhat. Asks Rava, why? Why should tzaddikim be at risk when it comes to shochad? What are we afraid of? That for a few pennies they're going to be bribed? And this question really can only be understood. Rav's question can only be understood if we understand the extent of the issur of bribery. The extent of the issur of bribery we see in a few examples. The melech. Who was the melech? The melech was also a tzaddik. The melech, when a king was properly chosen, we're talking about a melech. The melech David. Shaul HaMelech, Shlomo HaMelech, we're talking about great tzaddikim. Shaul HaMelech, when he was appointed king, and Shaul was not the greatest of our kings, when Shaul was appointed king, he had never sinned, he'd never done an aveira, not a single aveira. Shaul HaMelech, a tzaddik gomor, David HaMelech, Shlomo HaMelech, great people. And who are they appointed by? By the Sanhedrin. So imagine now, the Sanhedrin consists of the Gedolei Yisrael. Again, we don't have the Sanhedrin nowadays because we don't have people great enough. And we didn't have people great enough in a generation ago, or two generations ago, or three generations ago. So we're talking about people of greatness beyond our imagination. Sitting around and choosing a king, choosing a tzaddik to be a king. They, 70 tzaddikim, sit around and they decide who's going to be the king. 71. And it's approved by a Novi. The prophet approves it. And this great man, who is independent, who is righteous, who is a Talmid Chacham, who is God-fearing, when it comes to questions of Kiddush HaChodesh, when it comes to decide whether a year should be a leap year or it shouldn't be a leap year, we don't allow him to sit on the court that makes that decision. For what reason? Says the Gemara, and it's brought in the Halacha, in the Rambam. What reason don't we? Because the king pays his civil servants by the year. He fixes an annual salary for them. So if he gets an extra month in the year, he gets an extra month's free labor. So it's in his interest to make it a leap year. Once he has an interest in it, he can't be a judge. So what are we afraid of? Because he's going to get an extra month's labor out of his civil service. He's going to go against the halacha. He's going to paskin incorrectly. He's going to paskin untruly. Is that what we're afraid of? Another example, even more weird, the Kohen Godel. Kohen Godel also, tzaddik, kodosh, the Kohen Godel who goes Yom Kippur into the Kodesh Kodoshim, does the Avodah throughout Yom Kippur. Kohen Godel, the only person who's allowed into the Kodesh Kodoshim. And he too cannot sit on the court that decides whether it's going to be a leap year or not, because he also has an interest that it shouldn't be a leap year. Why? Because if he makes it a leap year, that means he makes an extra month of Adar, then Yom Kippur comes out a month later. And in Israel, if it comes out a month later, that means a month more into the winter. And on Yom Kippur, he's got to go into the mikveh a few times, the Kohen Godel, and it's cold. And even if they heat the water up, it still means getting undressed and into the mikveh and out of the mikveh. It's uncomfortable. And so he has an interest in seeing that it isn't a leap year. He wants Yom Kippur during the warmer time of the year, earlier rather than later. So he can't sit on the court either, because he's a nogea, he has an interest. That's how far this din goes, that no matter how great the tzaddik and how small the interest, he's still not allowed to sit on the court. And so the Gemara brings cases of Rabbi Shmuel but Rabbi Yossi, for example. Rabbi Shmuel but Rabbi Yossi have a ragil arise da have a maisile komali shabsa cancer the peri. Rabbi Shmuel but Rabbi Yossi, every Erev Shabbos, he's farm manager used to bring him a basket of fruit. Who did the fruit belong to? To the owner, Rabbi Shmuel Rabbi Yossi. It was his own fruit. But before Shabbos, he used to bring him a basket of his own fruit for Lichvod Shabbos. So one day he brought it on Thursday. Rabbi Yishmael, Rabbi Yossi said to his farm manager, well, what's the difference? Why today are you bringing it on Thursday? Normally you bring it on Friday. He said, I've got a case in the Beis Din today. There's an argument. I'm involved in a dispute in your Beis Din today, so I had to come into town. And while I was here, I thought I would give it to you. He said, sorry, I can't accept it. If you're going to be sitting before me in a matter at court, I can't accept the gift. It's not even a gift, it's his own payers, his own fruits. I can't accept it. He says, I would be no good for you as a judge. So he got another two rabbonin. In any case, even not taking it. So he now hasn't taken his own fruit, which he used to get in any case on Friday, but today it was bought a day earlier. He turns it down and still won't sit alone. He gets two other rabbonim to sit with him. He gets two other dayonim to sit on the case with him. And they judge him. But wherever he was going that day, Omar couldn't stop thinking of trying to find solutions for the claims of his manager. Omar, and he says, Tipach nafshun shemekabli shoichad. Then he said, he cursed the people who accept bribery. Uma ani shaloi notalti vim notalti shali notalti. I, says Rabbi Shmuel Rabbi Yossi, didn't accept it. And even had I accepted it, it was my own. It wasn't a bribe, it was my fruit. And yet I didn't even take it. And I still find myself unable to get my mind off finding ways to justify his claim. Can you imagine when a person really takes bribery, to what extent his mind becomes occupied in trying to find schus, in trying to find that litigant who paid him the bribe is right? And another case is Rabbi Shmuel Berelisha, the same kind of situation, a similar story. So we see to what degree the halacha goes in prohibiting bribery, no matter how tiny, with tzaddikim and talmidei chachomim, no matter how great. And that's why Rava asks, my time at the Shukta, what are we worried about? Are we really worried that the Kohen Gadol, because he's going to get a little chilly at Yom Kippur time, is going to paskin incorrectly? Is going to decide the matter incorrectly? Are we really worried that the king, because he's going to save a month's civil service pay, is going to try and get a leap year when there shouldn't be a leap year? What are we so worried about? Are we worried that Rabbi Shmuel Rabbi Yossi is going to find in favor of his manager because his manager brought him his own fruit on Thursday rather than Friday? It doesn't make any sense. So Rava explains a complicated psychological process and says it's not because we're afraid of the benefit that he's going to do it because he wants the money. That's not what we're worried about. These people are tzaddikim. They're not involved in the physical comforts or in the money. That's not what's important to them. MS is far more important to them. These are people who would give their lives for MS. These are people who would gladly sacrifice their lives for Torah and for mitzvahs and for MS. It would be nothing for them to give their lives. Are we worried that they're going to distort truth to avoid becoming chilly? That they're going to distort truth because they got a basket of fruit? Is that what we're worried about? That they're going to sacrifice their olam habo for a few apples and oranges? Is that what we're worried about? Says Rava, my time at the Sheikhad, what is the reason? Kivan de kabile shuchdo mine, once a person has accepted a bribe, ikravele daite, he says he has become close to him, vahavi kegufe, and he becomes like one, there's an identification, and a person doesn't like to find himself against himself. Asks the Chazon Ish, I've discussed this Chazon Ish with you before, and previously I spent a shiur explaining the Chazon Ish's viewpoint. This evening we'll explain the other viewpoint. Asks the Chazon Ish, if that's the case, that even a great tzaddik is not allowed to accept a bribe because we're afraid that he will paskin incorrectly, we're afraid that he will decide incorrectly, why is it that a rov is allowed to paskin his own shailas? You can have a rov who has a shaila over whether something's kosher or treif or whatever, and he can make his own decisions. He doesn't have to refer it to a colleague. Even if it's even if there's major financial risk or benefit involved. And the example I gave you last time, I think, is you can have a rov who's taken all his money, he's heard that the whiskey price is going to go up. And so he decides he's going to speculate. And he buys a shipload of whiskey. He borrows money, he puts his house on the mortgage, he borrows left, right and center, he's borrowed to his absolute limits. And everything he's got is bonded in personal securities, and that's everything, in order to buy a shipload of whiskey. because he's found out that the price of whiskey is going to go up by 25%, and within a month or two he will have made a lot of money. So he invests in the shipload of whiskey, and he's busy Erev Pesach selling everybody's chometz, and he forgets to sell his own shipload of whiskey. And comes the Shaila after Pesach, he's now got to decide what he's going to do with the shipload. Can it be used? Can't it be used? Or it can be a poor rov who invests his money in an ox. There's a wedding, there's a chasna, he puts all his money into an ox, into a cow. Or he thinks the price of meat is going up, puts everything he's got. The cow is shechted and there's a shayla. Is it kosher or is it treif? If it's treif, the rov has lost every penny. It's poor. If it's kosher, he's fine, he's okay, or he's made some money. Surely he should have to refer that shayla to a colleague. How can he trust himself to make a halachic decision in an area where he has a great financial interest? And the Chazon Ish says it goes further than that, because this belief that even tzaddikim are subject to bribery is the source of a great deal of apikursis. It becomes the source of a great deal of very, very bad and distorted viewpoints. Then you get people saying that such and such a rov said such and such because he has an interest. And you don't have to take any notice of him because he said it because he has an interest. And look, the Torah says, even great tzaddikim, if they have an interest in it, it's no good. They can't help it. So you'll say, he advised you to do so and so. This particular rov advised you to go to such and such a yeshiva. You know why? That's because he has an interest in that yeshiva. Or this rov advised you not to go to that yeshiva. It's because he has an interest in another yeshiva. Whatever the case is. And people ascribe self-interest motivations to Talmidei Chachomim. Says the Chazon Ish, that's very serious, because when that starts happening, the whole process of Torah authority disappears. You can always justify whatever you want to and undo whatever you want to by finding some kind of interest or self-interest, and that's it. You know why such and such a godel picked a fight with such and such? Because he had some kind of personal interest. Did you see in the newspaper the report the other day that you remember this business going on with a South African lady who went to Switzerland and came back Jewish, and she was a beauty queen, yeah, and she was converted by an Orthodox rabbi there, which of course is very peculiar in many, many ways, but so it was. And of course her conversion is not at all valid, and she came back to the Beis Din here, and they weren't prepared to accept the validity of the conversion, quite rightly so. So there were all sorts of discussions as to what and what. There was one article in the paper, I don't know if you saw it, with a whole pilpul worked out there, that Rabbi Jacobowitz, the chief rabbi of England, is about to retire. And two of the candidates, which isn't so, but anyway, two of the candidates are the chief rabbi of South Africa and this rabbi in Switzerland. So the chief rabbi of South Africa decided not to accept the conversion of the rabbi in Switzerland, so as to discredit the rabbi of Switzerland, so that he would get the job rather than the rabbi in Switzerland. The pilpul to which people will go in order to ascribe ulterior motive to halachic decisions. And there's no end to it. You can destroy any kind of halachic authority. You can make a mockery of anything by ascribing ulterior motive. And if one believes that a Talmid Chochem has ulterior motive in a halachic decision, then the whole of Torah collapses. Because what is Torah? What is Musar? What is Halacha? The training of oneself to do that which is right, even if it's not of interest to oneself. That's what halacha is, to do what's right when it's of interest to oneself. That's not halacha, that's not musar. The whole training is to learn and to regulate oneself to do that which is right, to fight for emes, to stand for emes, to practice emes. That's what Torah is all about. And a Talmid Chochem, a tzaddik, a godel be Yisrael, who his whole life has worked on himself to develop that capacity of fighting for emes and standing for emes and sacrificing his life and reputation for emes. What are we worried about? That he's going to, these ulterior motives are going to come into his halachic decisions? Says the Chazon Ish, that's absurd, we can't accept that. There's no fear that that's going to happen. And the proof of it is that a Talmid Chochem is allowed to paskin his own shailas. No matter how much money is involved, we trust the Talmid Chochem completely to reach an accurate halachic decision, even if he has interest. We're not worried about interest in halachic decisions. In that case, ask the Chazon Ish, how do we explain this pasuk? So why then is a Talmid Chochem not allowed to sit in judgment over two people, one of whom he has received benefit from? The case of the farm manager, or whatever case. A man is sitting as a dayan, two people before him, and the one he received some, has some kind of interest. Why are we afraid? So if he has millions of rands of interest in a shayla, that we allow him to paskin himself. But if he have one, see, if he has one cent of interest in a litigation, then he can't become involved. Why not? Says the Chazanish, that's a gzeras hakosuf. It's not because we're afraid the rabbi will distort the truth. That's not what we're worried about. That's a law in the Torah. That's it. And since it's a law in the Torah, now this is the beautiful part of the Chazanish. He says, and since it's a law of the Torah, then we find that the special siyata dishmaya, the special heavenly guidance which assists the Talmid Chochem in maintaining his integrity, is removed from him if he involves himself in cases in which he shouldn't be involved in the first place. If a Rav gets involved in a case, in a situation where he has the authority and he needs to be doing it, then there's a special siyata dishmaya. It's an amazing thing. One sees it over and over again. If one is involved in an area where one has the responsibility, the Ribbono Shel Olam helps. If one's involved in an area where one doesn't have the responsibility, then the Ribbono Shel Olam doesn't help. I might have told you once of the story that Rabbi Sternberg told me of the Yeshuas Yaakov, who was walking through a town. Not, it wasn't a town where he was the Rav. He was a great Rav, and one of his specialities was kashrus, shechita. And he's walking past a butcher, and the butcher sees him, walks past and shouts at him. He says, ask the Shuas Yaakov to come in. He says, I'm so pleased to see you. Right now we've got a shayla. I can't get hold of our Rav. We need to know, is the animal kosher or treif? And the Shuas Yaakov looks at it carefully, thinks a moment, and he says, it's kosher. And the butcher thanks him very much. In those days, this is a major shayla, because the meat, treif meat, wasn't used by the goyim. They didn't used to use the same animals. So if an animal was treif, it was a major loss to the butcher. It was a terrible, terribly serious thing. So the butcher was very grateful. The Yeshuas Yaakov Paskin was kosher, and off he went. And in the middle of the night, the Yeshuas Yaakov woke up with a nightmare. He woke up in such a cold sweat and a panic. He'd forgotten the taz in Shulchan Aruch, and in fact the animal was treif. So he ran back out of bed, and he went to look for the butcher. He knocked on the butcher's door, and he found him eventually. He said, I'm terribly sorry, I made a mistake. The animal I looked at is not kosher, it's treif. The butcher said, Rebbe, there was a wedding tonight. The animal's gone. Everybody's eaten the animal already. There's nothing left of it. So the Yeshuas Yaakov said, that I forgot the taz. That the Ribbono Shel Olam's not going to get angry at me for that. Anybody can forget something. That can happen. But that I paskined in a town that wasn't mine, for that I won't be forgiven. I wasn't protected by the siyata dishmaya that a Rav has when he gets involved in an area where he has to get involved, where it's his responsibility. To get involved in an area which is not your responsibility, there's no siyata dishmaya. If there's no siyata dishmaya, you're on your own. And it's almost impossible to come out right. There are just so many elements in the paskening of a shayla that it's almost impossible to come out if one doesn't have siyata dishmaya. I remember once, very early on in my career, a lady brought a chicken in with a shayla. It used to happen in those days. And it was one of the first shaylas on a chicken that I had, and I was quite nervous about it. But luckily there was a Rosh Hashiva. There was a Gaon, a wonderful Talmid Chochem, who also had experience a little bit in this area of Halacha. And he was there as well, and the chicken was there, and we took out the Shulchan Aruch, and I had somebody to talk it through with. And we're talking, and we come to the conclusion it's kosher. And then he asks a kasha, and he says, no. Then we come to the conclusion it's treif. And then he found a Prima Godim, he says, not tak, it's kosher. Then he found a Vilna Gaon, he said, that's treif. And this was going backwards and forwards, kosher and treif, kosher and treif, kosher and treif. Eventually he said, I can't decide, he said. I said, a good deal of help you are. And what are we going to do now? He said, you decide. I said, you can't decide. You're a Gaon, you're an Ilu, you're a Boki Bashas, you know Shulchan Aruch inside out. You can't decide, and you're telling me to decide. He says, you'll have Siyata Dishmaya. I don't. It's not my town. It's not my community. For me, it's an academic thing. So academic, I see all the sides to say kosher, all the sides to say treif, I can't reach a conclusion. But you're the Rav. We've gone through it. You sit down with the Shulchan Aruch and you make your own decision. And so it is. It's a different thing. There's a different siyata dishmaya when one has the responsibility. Says the Chazon Ish, if a Rav gets involved in a case that he's forbidden to get involved in, then there's no siyata dishmaya. Then Hashem doesn't help him. If Hashem doesn't help him, he's going to come out crooked. So how does one avoid being affected by self-interest? Siyata dishmaya, the Ribbono Shel Olam helps you. But where there is no such support, one is going to be affected by self-interest. So the way the Chazon Ish works it again is the following. The reason for which that Torah says, v'shad lo yisikach, is not because we're afraid that for the money he's going to distort the din. The din is, it's a gzeras hakosuf, you're not allowed to do it. And last time we discussed this, I explained it using a shita mekubetzis and bava kama as to why one isn't allowed to do it. That's a kosev. It's got nothing to do with fear of distortion. But once you're not allowed to do it, the siyata dishmaya is removed, and once the siyata dishmaya is removed, you will in fact land up distorting. So the fear of distorting is the consequence, not the cause. It's not prohibited because we're afraid you'll distort. You will distort because it's prohibited, and you have no right getting involved in it in the first place. That's the way the Chazon Ish learns it. And he says, so what are we going to say then about the case of paskening the Kohen and the king paskening laws of leap years and so on? Why shouldn't he pasken there? What's the self-interest there? Is not so important. That's like paskening a Shaila. And he proves from the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah and Daf Kafhei that the paskening of matters of the calendar is called Mishpat. Ki choikli Yisrael hu Mishpat leilokei Yaakov. This is part of Mishpatim. And just as the Gemara says in Rosh Hashanah that it has to be done in the daytime, like other Mishpat, so the laws of Mishpat apply. This is considered like part of Choshen Mishpat, like litigation. It's the same principles, and just as in matters of litigation one can't get involved if there's any kind of interest, so in matters of paskening the calendar one can't get involved if there's any interest. That's a Gzeres HaKosuv, it's a law of the Torah, that's it, finished. That's the story. That's how the Chazon Ish learns it. But Notetzvi Finkel does not learn it that way. And he says, Bepashtus, he says, this is no Gzeres HaKosuv. It's quite clear that it's no Gzeres HaKosuv from the Posuk. V'sheichad lo tikoch, you shall not take bribery. And the Torah doesn't stop there. It goes on, ki ha-sheichad yaver pichim. There's a reason why you can't take bribery. Because bribery distorts even the minds of the wisest of men. Says Reb Nota Tzvi Finkel, nobody can escape this. This is a psychological fact built into the creation of the human being that he will be affected by bribery and he will distort his judgment as a result of bribery. You can't say this is a Gzeres HaKosuv when the Torah gives a reason. Ki ha-sheichad yaver pichim. That's what Reb Nota Tzvi Finkel says, and it's a very strong time. It's a very strong case. But then we left with Reb Nota Tzvi Finkel, we left with the Chazon Ish's question. It's all very well that the Torah gives a reason. You can't take bribery because we're afraid of distortion. But then why can a Rav pasken his own shailas? If financial interest is a reason to fear distortion, how can a Rav pasken his own shaila if he has a lot of money involved in it? And this becomes, it's a big issue because it affects all areas of self-interest. What happens if a person from my community comes to me and says, I want to ask you advice. For the following reasons, I think it might be in my interest to leave your community and go and study somewhere else. So the person can say to himself, but I can't ask my Rav that child. Of course he'll tell me to stay. If a person says that or thinks that, he has no business having been there in the first place. To learn Torah under a Rav who one fears will paskin a shaila for his own interest, that's no Rav. One has no right. If that's what one fears could be, one had no right to be there all the time. That can't be. It affects everything. That means you can't ask advice. That means you can't consult. If there's any kind of interest at all, this becomes a very, very primary principle. To what extent is one bound by the decisions of a Rav where the Rav himself has interests? So we're going to explain the Chazon Ish's question in a way that will answer it for Reb Nota Tzvi Finkel. Again, Reb Nota Tzvi Finkel says this is not a Gzeres HaKosuv, this is not just a law without a philosophy. This is a law with a rational reason for the law, and the rational reason is given in the Torah. Ki ha-sheichad yaver pichim. You can't take bribery because we're afraid it will distort the justice. Asks the Chazon Ish, if we're afraid that interest will distort justice, why can a Rav paskin shailas where he has an interest in them? That's the question. So we need to distinguish and say, where is a Rav allowed to paskin and where is he not? In matters of Urachayim and Yerodeah, he can paskin. Urachayim and Yerodeah are those areas of Shulchan Aruch which involve davening and Sifrei Torah and mezuzahs and Shabbos and Yom Tov. It's Urachayim. And Yerodeah involves Kashrus and mikvahs and nido and interest, laws of ribis, interest, isur veheter, things which are permitted and prohibited. In those areas, a Rav can paskin, he doesn't need to, even if he has self-interest. So a Rav can be a trader in mezuzahs, and he can still decide whether a mezuzah is kosher or not. A Rav might be, his income might come from selling mezuzahs, and you can still come to him with a mezuzah and say to him, I've been offered this mezuzah from another trader. Is it kosher or isn't it? And we're not worried that the Rov will find something wrong with it in order that you should buy the mezuzah from him rather. And so with Sifrei Torah, and so with Kashrus, all those areas, the Rov can paskun on his own. Comes to Choshen Mishpat, the laws of litigation, there he can't paskun on his own. He can't paskun if he has an interest in any form of litigation. Why not? What's the difference? I asked Rabbi Hager this afternoon what he thought was the difference, and he said a very nice idea. It just doesn't work all the way through, but the idea is nice. He said, a human being can reach a conclusion against his own interests. That's not superhuman. Provided nobody else is benefiting at his cost. But if by finding against me somebody else benefits, that's hard for a human being to do. So if I've got to find that my animal is treif, good. So the animal gets lost, what can I do? And if my ship of whiskey has to be thrown out, it has to be thrown out, what can we do? But to find when there are two litigants and I've got to find against myself in favor of somebody else, that's difficult to do. But the reason that doesn't work is because of the case of the Kohen Gadol. The Kohen Gadol isn't allowed to sit on the case deciding on the Beis Din that decides whether there's 13 months in the year or 12 months in the year. Why? So that it shouldn't be too cold when he gets in the water. Nobody else has got an interest in that case. So the theory, although it's nice psychologically, the theory doesn't work in halacha all the way through. Let's have a look carefully at what Rava says. What is the reason for Shechat? Says Rava, Kivan de kabile shuchta mine. Once a person has accepted a bribe, ikriv le daite legabe, he becomes identified, he develops an identity with that particular person. He empathizes with that person, that there is an identification with that person. Vahavi kegufe, and that person's interests are merged with his own. Ve'ein odom roye choyve la'atzme, and a person doesn't find himself to be wrong. That a person doesn't find. My shoychad, and the word shoychad, what does it mean in fact? Shehu chad. Shoychad means hu chad, he's one. The two of them become one. So the reason for shoychad is not that we're afraid that he'll do it for financial benefit. The financial benefit brings about a kiruv hadas, it brings the two people close together. It merges their personalities to the point where finding against the giver of the bribe is like finding against myself. One doesn't want to do that. So it's a different psychology altogether. Let's see the case again. There's Reuven and Shimon have a case together. And Reuven comes and gives me a basket of fruit before. That basket of fruit makes me feel very close to Reuven, which is a concept all on its own, which we'll discuss in a moment. But it makes me feel very close to him. And when I see the two of them before me, and Reuven puts his case, I feel as if it's our case, not his case. That's our case. And that's not good. Once it's our case, it's not in order. Then I'm already having, if I will find against Reuven, it will mean I'm finding against me. Because since Reuven gave me the basket of fruit or whatever it was, my mind has been going, as we saw with Rabbi Shmuel, Rabbi Yossi, my mind has already been working to find points in favor of Reuven. And when Reuven gets up and says this and lays his claim and puts his case, I think to myself, that's exactly what I was thinking. And if I'm going to find in favor of Shimon, I'm finding against myself. And in an argument, people don't like to find against themselves. That we don't like to find that I'm wrong. Certainly not at the point where one's already coming to court. If one's having a theoretical argument, fine, one can be big enough to be murdered to accept defeat. But when one's gone as far as actually coming to court, to accept defeat is very, very difficult. And that's why so many things come to court, and that's why sometimes one thinks it's absurd. Surely one should be able to see more or less without actually having gone to court. In many of the cases, surely the lawyers themselves can see which way it's going to go, and they could advise an individual and say, don't go to court, it's not worth your while, you lose. Only one can win. But it isn't like that. Once you've gone that far, you can't see the possibility of losing. Each one is convinced that he's going to win. And once you're convinced that you're going to win, and you've staked things on it, and you've staked your reputation on it, and you've put money into it, it's very difficult to argue against yourself at that point. That's what Rova says. in a case of litigation, well, let's define it this way. What is the difference then between Arachayim and Yorodeya on the one hand, the first two sections of Shulchan Aruch, and Choshen Mishpat on the other hand? The difference is that in Arachayim and Yorodeya we're dealing with objects. In Choshen Mishpat we're dealing with people. Now in Arachayim one can also be dealing with people. Hilchos Nido, the laws of family purity, are in Yorodeya. So if a woman comes to ask a shayla as to whether she may or may not live with her husband at that particular time, you're dealing with people. It's true that you're dealing with people, but the halacha is going to be decided on the basis of facts, of scientific facts, that's all. You need to know whether if it's kashrus, you just need to know what the facts are. And once you know what the facts are and you know the halacha, you can draw your halachic conclusion. And you need to research the facts well, and you need to know the halacha as well, and then you can draw a conclusion. In Choshen Mishpat, there's another element, there's another dimension. Reuven and Shimon come before the judge, and Reuven says, I lent Shimon money on such and such a day at such and such a place, and Shimon says, you didn't, you're a liar. Didn't? Absolutely untrue. I was never at such a place, at such a time, and I never saw you before, I don't know what you're talking about. The judge now has to decide. But the judge has no facts. He wasn't there. So what's he going to do? It becomes a matter of believing one or the other. With witnesses and so on, we'll discuss in a moment. But at the end of the day, his decision is, which of the two am I going to believe? Ne'emonus, believing, is already something which involves the emotions. That's not just cold fact. And it's impossible to decide who to believe if one feels an identification to one of the parties. Because we're not prepared to disbelieve ourselves. So let's now refine what we said earlier. I said earlier that you can concede defeat in an abstract argument, but not when you've come to court. Let's refine that a little further. One can concede defeat in an abstract argument, but not in a matter of integrity. If I've said something based on a rational argument, and you argue against me, and you prove me wrong, that there's a flaw in my logic, it's not difficult for me to say, you're right. Didn't think of that. You're right. I'm wrong. Because that is no moral indictment of myself. Good, so I'm not as clever as you. I didn't think it through as carefully as you. I thank you for pointing out to me that I made a mistake. That's no moral indictment. But if I say to you, you know what, I gave 1,000 rand of tzedakah yesterday, and you say to me, you're a liar. And I say, I'm not. How can you call me? We have an argument. I did, you didn't, I did, you didn't. At the end, for me to say, you're right, I am a liar. Very hard. Who's going to say that? Yeah, thank you for pointing it out. I'm exactly a liar. I'm a chakra. Who's prepared to do that? We're not prepared to do that. So where there's a moral indictment involved, Ein Adam Roye Chovo Le'atzmo. There I can't look at myself. It is not fair to expect a human being to find a moral flaw with himself in an argument with somebody else. If nobody else is involved, one can do it. It's hard enough. But one can do it. If you're involved in self-analysis and in self-examination, and particularly if it's Elul time, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur time, I can find plenty of flaws within myself, but it's not with anybody else involved. If somebody else comes and accuses me of a moral flaw, and I defend myself and say that's not true, then it's very difficult for me afterwards to concede defeat and to say, yes, I am in fact a nobody, I am in fact immoral, I lack integrity, I am a crook, I'm deceitful. People don't do that. And therefore, once I'm identified with one of the sides in the litigation, by finding in favor of the other side, I must say that I am a liar. Our side are wrong, not just in halacha, we're wrong in what we're saying. What about the case of the king? What about the case of the Kohen Gadol? What's their sides there? What's the moral indictment? We've got to decide whether to make Kiddush HaChodesh or not, whether it's going to be 30 days in the month or 29 days in the month, whether they're going to be 13 months or 12 months in the year. Good, so I'm thinking of it would be nice if Yom Kippur was earlier this year, so it won't be too cold for me when I go into the mikveh. Fine, okay. But is it difficult for me to... Where's the moral indictment involved? Where's the identification of one of the sides? Who are the two sides here? But how do we decide matters of Kiddush HaChodesh? We decide with witnesses. The moon has to have been seen. Witnesses come along. Witnesses are cross-examined. The whole thing has to be analyzed. The question is, am I going to accept the witnesses or am I not going to accept the witnesses? and I have an interest to accept the words of the witnesses. Once I have an interest in accepting the words of the witnesses, I identify with the witnesses. That's our case. It's very subtle and very subconscious. But deep down, when those witnesses come along and say, we saw the new moon, we've got to make it, it's time. I feel happy with that, I identify with that. That's good, that's just what I want to be as well. And then to find that those witnesses are liars after I've identified with them, that's very hard. To find sheker in somebody that I've identified with is very, very hard indeed. I've often explained to you how Hanifa works, that's how flattery works. If I come along to you and I say, I build you up and I tell you that you're handsome and you're brilliant and you're a tzaddik and all sorts of wonderful things. And then I tell you I need to borrow 10,000 rand from you, just need it for a few days and so on. And somebody else comes to you and says, how can you lend him 10,000 rand? He's a crook, how can you lend him? What are you going to say? I'm sure he's a crook, yeah. And when he told me that I'm a genius, that he was a crook. And when he told me that I'm handsome, he was a crook. When he told me I'm wonderful, he was a crook. We're not going to accept that. Once a person has told us the kind of things we want to hear, we believe that they are the most honest people in the world. We'll stand up for them, we'll fight for them, we'll call them men of integrity. Because we're not prepared to accept that they were lying when they said those things that we identified with. That's how flattery works. Once you've flattered a person, you have bought his commitment to your integrity. That person can no longer afford to acknowledge that you can lack integrity. That's why one finds so often, one asks, doesn't the person see that he's being taken for a ride? How do these charlatans work? How do these con men work? They always work with flattery. That's the tool of their trade, is with flattery. Their first thing is to make you feel good. Once they've made you feel good, you dare not accept that they're liars, because then you become deflated. Your whole ego depends now on your belief in their integrity. They've built you up, and they're holding you up. And if you're going to floor their integrity, you're going to drop on the ground and smash. So it pays you, there's no question that you're going to believe them. And that's how that relationship of trust is built up. Through the flattery, through the complimenting, and through that personal relationship. And so it is in all matters of Mishpat. When witnesses are involved, when two sides are involved, where there's self-interest, if there has been the slightest form of identification with one of the sides, and my decision is going to involve a moral indictment, I'm no longer capable to judge. Because I might have to find a moral indictment against our side. And that I can't be expected to do. That's hasheichad yaver pikhim, no matter how wise one is. To find a moral indictment against oneself is very, very hard. That can't be done. And that's what Rova means. That the principle of sheichad is not the fear that the person will distort because he's been paid and he wants the money. The money is the root cause. That brings about a subconscious closeness and identification. And the identification then becomes the problem. Then it becomes a kirav adas, an odom korov latzmoy, en roi chove latzmoy. The person doesn't see any kind of moral indictment against himself, and the whole relationship changes. What we see here is, firstly, the importance of distinguishing situations where an opinion needs to be reached as a result of the analysis of facts, and when an opinion needs to be reached as a result of trust, as a result of reliance on an authority. Where facts are involved, one has to know that a human being can, depending on what on his own moral stature. But where it's a matter of fact, he can disassociate himself, and he can look at it scientifically and coldly. It's possible, and he's expected to do so. So if we have to reach a business decision, for example, and we would like the decision to be A, that's what would really suit us, and we've now got to decide whether that's exactly the right thing to do or not. It depends. If that decision is based on facts, we can look at it coldly. It's possible to disassociate oneself from it and to analyze the facts coldly and to draw one's conclusion and to make a decision. But if part of that business decision means relying on other people, and you've got to discuss it with one person, you've got to discuss it with another person, and they can't give you facts. It's really a question. A person says to you, look, on the facts of the matter, you can't draw a conclusion. There are not enough facts. You need to know things behind the scenes, what goes on behind the scenes, for which there's no documentary evidence. And I'll tell you what goes on behind the scenes, and one person tells you how wonderful a business it is and what a good investment it will be, and so on, and another person tells you what a bad investment it is and how bad it will be. At that point, one really can't judge anymore. At that point, I have an interest that it should come out one way. I don't have my own facts. I've got to rely on the opinions of others. I have two conflicting opinions, and I identify with the one opinion, with the one that tells me to go the way I would like to go. That means I'm no longer in a position to make a decision. That's where one then has to refer to a third party and say, look, you have no interest in this decision. You listen to A, and you listen to B, and you question them, and you tell me who you think is telling the truth. I can't do it. I can't be a dyer in such a case. I've got to recuse myself. One needs to know when one can trust oneself and when one cannot trust oneself, on what basis one can trust oneself and on what basis one can't. If one has a self-interest, one can still detach oneself, provided the decision can be made on the basis of facts rather than the basis of opinions. When it comes to opinions, there's personal relationships involved. And with personal relationships, there's identification, and where there's identification, there's the danger of not wanting to find the flaw with one's own argument. And that applies in all areas where one has to make decisions. And the other important yisoid that emerges from this is the enormous power of kiruv hadas, the enormous power of attracting people, of making a person feel close to one, how easy it is. It's quite amazing to think that a people of the stature of Rabbi Shmuel, Rabbi Yossi, and the others we've talked about, a king, a melech, a kohen gadol, for very small benefits, already identify, establish a relationship and an identification with one particular party, to the extent where that may override their sense of rationalization and their objective reasoning. And so it is that one needs to find in one's interrelationships with people, and to understand that the building of those relationships depend upon, among other things, the small things. It doesn't have to be big things, small things in life, but where people derive benefit from one another. The little thoughtfulnesses, the little gifts, these are little things, but they all bring kiruv hadas. And kiruv hadas, Rashi describes here, Rashi defines, Hanoisein v'hamekabel nasim leiv echod. Giver and receiver develop one heart. It's a beautiful phrase. That a noisein and a mekabel can develop one leiv, can develop one heart. And that really has to be the relationships that take place in any situation where one wants a kiruv hadas. In a marriage, that's an important yisoid to know. But at the end of the day, there can be a leiv echod. There's a giving and a receiving. Giver and receiver become united. Their interests merge. And any two people, parents and children, friends, partners, chavrusas, colleagues, whoever it is, the little thoughtfulnesses, the little things, it's not the basket of fruit. The fruit, don't forget, belonged to Rabbi Shmuel, Rabbi Yossi. It wasn't the money that was spent. No money was spent. The farm manager brought the fruit. Whose fruit? He brought his own fruit. What was the kiruv hadas? What brought about the giving and taking? Just the trouble. The fact that he took the trouble to bring it, that was enough. That was all that was necessary. It's not so much the financial involvement as the emotional involvement that results out of the thoughtfulness, out of the fact that somebody has taken the trouble to do a little thing. That's something which brings such kiruv hadas. That's something which brings people so close together when there is that thoughtfulness. And today we run rushed lives and pressurized lives, and this is one of the casualties of those lives. And we try and make it up monetarily, materially. It doesn't really help. At the end of the day, it's the thoughtfulness. It's dropping a little card, it's a phone call, it's a coming around to say hello. It's just a little thing to say, to show another person thinking of you, you're important to me. That brings about a kiruv hadas, hanoisein v'hamekabel nasim leiv echod, where giver and receiver of those thoughtfulnesses become leiv echod, become one mind, one heart. There's a closeness, there's an intimacy, there's a resolution of a loneliness and an isolation and an alienation that results from that. A leiv echod, where warmth is developed, intimacy is developed, and there's love which is developed too.